The United States Constitution has been written and argued about for over two centuries, and there are some who think a lot of those arguments are being put to the test as we speak.
Donald Trump is a stress test for the Constitution.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a constitutional scholar tells us how he thinks the old document is doing. We'll also spend an academic minute thinking about the next election. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Say what you want about the last 2 years, historians are going to have a field day once they get their hands on them. It seems there's a new crisis every other day, and people on both sides of issues are pointing to the Constitution to make their case. So, how's the Constitution holding up in this brave new political world? To answer that question, we thought we'd invite back the authors of the book Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. Dr. Sanford Levinson is a professor of law and government at the University of Texas Law School and is a constitutional scholar. And Cynthia Levinson is a writer of nonfiction for young readers. Their book has just been released in paperback with additions and revisions. So I asked them, why make all those changes to the book?
We had been blogging for the first 2 years about the book every 2 weeks to keep that one updated because the book is so current. It's not that it becomes obsolete, but there are ever more examples of how relevant the book is to today. So our editor at Peachtree Publishers asked us to update it, and we did so in two sweeping ways. One is that we added an entire new part with two new chapters specifically on presidential powers. That part is called, Can the President Really Do That? And the two chapters, one on whom can the president pardon and the other on whom can the president fire, became very especially particularly relevant over the last 2 years since the presidential election. The other sweeping way that we updated the book is that really everything in it is brought up to speed. So every statistic, every datum, every graphic, every change that a state or another country made has been brought up to date in the book.
Yeah, I would also just add one thing, that Donald Trump is a stress test for the Constitution. I mean, there was a lot of talk now about 10 years ago of putting banks under stress tests to see if they could respond adequately to financial crises. And as we know, a number of them couldn't. So if you were from Mars, you would view the Trump presidency as just a wonderful opportunity to test a variety of hypotheses, because almost literally every day brings new stresses.
And in fact, we continue to blog about the book, not every 2 weeks now, but every month.
Well, what over the past 2 years have you thought really highlighted the fault lines in the Constitution?
My answer to that, and I don't know if it's Cynthia's answer or not, but what I think has really been underlined, and fortunately we do talk about this in the book, is problems with a fixed-term presidency where the only way of firing a president is impeachment. I think it is pretty much clear now that the impeachment clause just doesn't work. Many other countries, but also if you look at California and Wisconsin in this country, have ways of firing leaders in whom they've lost confidence. They can have, in fact, no confidence votes by legislatures, or in California, Wisconsin, you can have recall elections. I think one of the things that Donald Trump has demonstrated, from my way of thinking, is that we would be much better off if there were an alternative to impeachment, and we could put pressure on legislators to explain why they have confidence in him, or, as in California or Wisconsin, we could be getting signatures from other citizens to have a recall election.
And I would add to Sandy's response that one of the reasons this is something to take seriously is that there in the last 2 years has been a rebalancing or imbalancing of the checks and balances that the Constitution is said to be known for. The executive branch has swayed so much of what has happened, or in fact not happened, especially in terms of passage of legislation, which has hardly taken place, that we really are rethinking that notion of checks and balances in the Constitution. We're beginning to see how faulty that is.
Right. One final example, that Congress has done very little, but two things that have been very important and have required bipartisan votes is attempts to limit Trump's power with regard to selling arms to Saudi Arabia and participating in an extraordinarily vicious civil war in Yemen. He vetoed both of those, and we have a chapter in our book about the veto power and how, in effect, we have a tricameral rather than a bicameral system of government. And the president, with a single vote, gets to negate what bipartisan majorities of Congress might want, unless, you know, all the planets align and you have two-thirds of each house willing to override.
Has the executive gotten too much power over the judiciary? I mean, the judiciary is the final word, but it's the executive that pretty much shapes it.
Right. The fact is, Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell are simply illustrating what is possible if you have an ideologically zealous president and an ideologically zealous majority in the Senate. They can do whatever they want. Mitch McConnell has devoted his last couple of years to capturing the judiciary for the far right. One can say that violates some sort of constitutional spirit, but there is nothing unconstitutional about the president nominating whomever he wants as a judge and a majority of the Senate confirming that person.
They are playing by the rules, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. It's the rules that we ought to be talking about rather than merely denouncing political figures we don't like.
And by rules, in this case, as Sandy often points out, it's the structures established by the Constitution that are being taken advantage of.
Well, I think the biggest example of that would be the Merrick Garland situation. There's really no rule that says they have to take this up now.
Right. You're absolutely right. There's okay, nothing more to say that one can denounce Mitch McConnell up and down, but what I think can't be said is that he behaved unconstitutionally.
I'd like to go into something you do talk about the book that was highlighted over the past couple of years, is the time between the election and when the president takes office, the lame duck period.
I'm thrilled that you asked this question. I've been arguing now for literally about 20 years that is a time bomb feature of the Constitution in two quite different ways. One way is that it means if an incumbent is beaten, as happened with George H.W. Bush in 1992, or if the incumbent is rejected, as one could very easily say was the case in 2008, then during the interim, in a practical sense, we don't have a functioning government, because the person who's been elected to lead has no legal power, and the person with all the legal power has, in effect, been repudiated. So that's one problem. But you've also put your finger on another very, very deep problem, which is that thanks to what we now call the transition, we really have little or no idea whom presidential candidates will be appointing to top offices. So we elect pigs in a poke and have faith that they will appoint decent people. One of the virtues of a parliamentary system, though frankly you don't need to go all the way to parliamentarianism to have a better system, is that in a parliamentary system, you know not only who the prime minister will be, but you often have a very, very good idea who the foreign secretary, the defense minister, the secretary of the treasury will be, and Americans don't.
This also relates actually to the Electoral College, which is the reason that the inauguration takes place as late as it does. So it's sort of a multi-tiered problem.
If you look at most foreign countries and most American states, there's a much shorter period of time between election and inauguration. Alaska, for example, will inaugurate its new governor on December 1st, so there's a three-week period. England, if there is a clear winner in an election, the winner moves into 10 Downing Street literally the next day. We are really an outlier in now having about 11 weeks between an election and the inauguration. As I say, this means that we are without a genuinely functioning government, as well as just, you know, picking up the newspapers every day and wondering, well, who is going to be our Secretary of State? Who is going to be the Secretary of the Treasury? All very, very important offices that we give this one person basically a carte blanche ability to pick.
Yeah, we do appreciate your asking this question because it's not one that many people pay attention to, and there it is.
It used to be longer. It used to go into March.
That's right.
Yeah, we talk about the 20th Amendment, and I'm a big, big fan of the 20th Amendment. 1933, it moved Inauguration Day up from March 4th to January 20th. It moved the beginning of a new Congress from the truly insane December of the year following the election to the beginning of January. These are very important changes, but what I really love about the 20th Amendment is that it exemplifies the fact that there was once a time when Americans really took seriously the fact that structural reform, which is a phrase you hear from more and more, particularly the Democratic candidates, where structural reform meant constitutional reform.
Still to come, our conversation with Sandy and Cynthia Levinson continues with a look at how tough it is to amend the Constitution. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guests today are Cynthia and Sandy Levinson, authors of the book for students called Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. During our conversation, I wondered if this has been the longest we've gone without a constitutional amendment.
Let me do a quick bit of arithmetic. The last constitutional amendment, which is also the most bizarre constitutional amendment we talk about in our book, it's the so-called 27th Amendment.
We refer to it as the term paper amendment.
Yeah, it was added to the Constitution in 1992, though it had been proposed in 1789, and it was revived, actually, as Cynthia suggests, by a University of Texas undergraduate who discovered that it was still, in theory, alive. He said, you know, it could still be ratified.
It has to do with salaries, right, whether or not Congress right. can vote itself right. salaries in its current
yeah.
term.
It got a C because it
on
seemed
the paper.
Just so crazy that anything proposed in 1789 could still be alive and well. But, in fact, he lobbied a lot of state legislatures, and if you turn to the current Constitution, you'll find the 27th Amendment. So that's 1992, which is, what, 27 years? So, in fact, you had a longer period of time between the 12th Amendment in 1803, which involved presidential elections, and the 13th Amendment that got rid of slavery in 1866. The fact is, the United States Constitution is unusually difficult to amend, far more difficult to amend than the American state constitutions or most other national constitutions. So what you find is that amendments tend to occur in periods of crisis. And this is why I love the 20th Amendment. We're not very good about acting before the crisis, whether it's a civil war or depressions or things like that, and holding the kinds of conversations that actually I think the framers encouraged us to hold, that is, how well is the Constitution doing, and should it in fact be updated?
Can you foresee a scenario in the next 20 to 50 years where the Electoral College would actually be gone?
50 years.
You know, the answer has to be yes, that, hope, you know, partly because hope springs eternal. But the Electoral College is a wonderful example, unfortunately, of the huge, huge tilt of the Constitution toward the status quo, because it's so difficult to amend the Constitution.
Even though nobody likes it. Republicans don't like it, and Democrats
yeah.
don't like it.
Yeah, every poll since 1944, taken by the Gallup organization, has shown a majority of the American public being hostile to the Electoral College. There have been about 600 proposed amendments to get rid of it. But, as is obvious, we're stuck with it, partly because it takes two-thirds of each house, and often small state senators will vote against, or in the 1980s, large state senators from so-called battleground states tended to vote against. But even if you got it through the House, through the Congress, you would then have to get three-quarters of the states and their legislatures, and it's very easy to imagine 13 states who believe that they're advantaged by the Electoral College. So I think it would take a genuine popular movement that unfortunately isn't there. I think a lot of us thought that after 2000 and after 2016, people would be angry and demand action. And frankly, that hasn't taken place.
Well, about half the people are angry and demanding action. The other half are kind of happy.
Well, there are candidates, though, even Republican candidates. President Trump previously had said that he doesn't like the Electoral College. But Sandy's right. There are advantages to small states, and there are advantages to swing states, states that might not otherwise have a big voice or get, you know, lots of journalists coming through, for instance, every 4 years. Benefit from the Electoral College. So it's hard to see that their power structure would say, no, we'd all be better off without it. It's just not clear that we're that charitable, I guess.
I think talking about this brings out another one of the big inequities and fault lines that you see. And the question is, does Vermont deserve the same amount of senators as New York and California?
No.
Right.
You know, and I say that to be completely frank, as a Texan who doesn't like either of the Texan senators, that is Ted Cruz and John Cornyn, and tends to admire Bernie Sanders and Pat Leahy, but except in terms of raw partisan politics, there is no justification for Leahy and Sanders being able to counterbalance Cornyn and Cruz. I mean, Texas is a state with 28 million people. California has now about 40 million people. And each is counterbalanced by Wyoming and Vermont. And if you believe in any semblance of one person, one vote, that's indefensible. And James Madison agreed in 1787. Again, obviously we talk about this. He was vehemently opposed to the so-called Great Compromise that gave, in that instance, Delaware the same voting power as Virginia. And he was tempted to walk out of the convention, but ultimately said, we need a constitution, and we have to pay this extortionate price. But frankly, it's the same sort of logic as the compromise with slavery, which was necessary in order to get the Constitution. But nobody today would say, you know, that was really a great compromise, and we really have some duty to continue recognizing the legitimacy of slavery, because after all, the framers did.
You asked earlier about updates that we made to the book, and that's one example. There's a graphic in the book and some updated information about the inequities of senators and states. So one of the things we point out is that in 2018, less than half the U.S. population was represented by 82 senators, and more than half was represented by only 18 senators. And we also have a statistic that I believe we didn't have before, saying that forecasts indicate that in 2040, 70% of Americans, because we're becoming increasingly urbanized, will congregate in 15 states represented by only 30 senators, which means that the remaining 30% of the population will get 70 senators. That just doesn't make sense, and it's going to get worse and worse. As Sandy and I wrote the book together, he's the constitutional scholar, there are certainly many problems. How we divide up our congressional districts is a huge problem. The Electoral College is a huge problem. Voting rights is a huge problem. I really came to the conclusion that underlying many of these is the imbalance in the Senate. For me, that is probably the greatest fault line.
Well, to close out here, I'm going to fill the cup half full. In these past 2 years, what's been working? What makes you say, you know, this Constitution's doing a good job?
The people are abiding by it. For better or worse, we're recognizing the people we've elected to office.
Yeah. You know, there's a famous story, which may not be true in all its details, but the story is that Henry Kissinger, in one of his visits to China, asked Zhou Enlai if he thought the French Revolution had been a success. And Zhou Enlai is said to have responded, it's too early to tell. Quite frankly, I think it's too early to tell whether or not the Constitution has saved us or, in fact, is helping to doom us in the Trump presidency. Trump is certainly revealing some of the fault lines we talk about. If he should be reelected because of the Electoral College, and there was an article in the New York Times last week that said that he, in effect, could lose the popular vote by 5 million people and still cobble together 270 electoral votes, and if he would take reelection as a mandate to push ever more his flailing executive power, then I think you'd have to say the Constitution is an agent of doom. But it really is too early to tell.
Let me add a more positive note, though.
Please!
We end the book with how to work around these issues. The last chapter is called Now What? We do give guidelines on how some of these problems can be addressed, some through change of rules in Congress, passing laws. There are various workarounds proposed for the Electoral College and amendments. As difficult as it is, the Constitution can be amended. So there are ways to address these problems. Sandy hopes for a new constitutional convention. I don't. So our very last part of the book is a debate between us about that. But that could happen too. And maybe it would be for the betterment.
Cynthia Levinson is an author specializing in nonfiction for young readers, and Sandy Levinson is a professor of law and government at the University of Texas Law School. The name of their book, which has just been released and revised in paperback, is Fault Lines in the Constitution: The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. So what will the 2020 election mean for the Constitution and everything else for that matter? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Hope isn't just for campaign slogans. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Sarah Stitzline, professor of education at the University of Cincinnati, discusses how to put hope into action.
Even as kicking off, the 2020 presidential campaign reminds us that elections are a hallmark of democracy. We know that democracy is struggling in America today. Citizens increasingly feel cynical about our system and doubt they can influence public policy. Distrustful of other Americans and elected officials, some are even turning to authoritarian alternatives. Hyperpartisanship and recent contentious presidential elections have deepened political despair. While some citizens get swept up in optimism during campaign cycles, they often later find themselves frustrated with elected leaders as they wait for change. The problem is that the form of hope we tend to take up during elections doesn't involve sustained action. We may have hope, but we don't really do anything about it beyond casting a ballot or touting our preferred candidate. And we tend to think of hope as something that we possess as individuals, like a noun, rather than something that we do together as citizens, like a verb. One approach to reviving democracy based in pragmatist educational philosophy and psychological research is to teach citizens a better way to hope. This form of hope is more than just a campaign slogan or a self-help program. It is a call to informed citizen engagement. Schools and universities can cultivate hope in the habits of citizens by nurturing our proclivity to take action. They can create communities of inquiry that foster critique, nurture deliberation, cultivate imagination, and solve social problems. Those habits of hope can then sustain action within our civil society well past graduation. Learning how to hope and engaging in hoping together can build trust, grow political agency, and shape an improved American identity. Hope can animate life in a democracy, moving citizens forward through new challenges, new experiments, and new elections.
That was Sarah Stitzline of the University of Cincinnati. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.
Thank you.